This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Jude Rogers. Brace yourself, bunker listeners. Today we're talking about sperm and a subject that's no longer in the realm of sci-fi. If you've read or watched The Handmaid's Tale or Children of Men, you'll have seen dystopian visions of the future based on the idea of global infertility. We're not there yet, obviously, but today's guest, an award-winning American environmental and reproductive epidemiologist, is the author of a book with the title To Give Us All Pause, Countdown: How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Here to tell us why we should be concerned and what we can do is Shanna H. Swan. Welcome, Shanna, to The Bunker. How are you doing?
Hi, Jude. Thank you. I'm doing fine, and I'm happy to be talking to you today about this important topic.
So the full title of your book is pretty terrifying. Did you want to shake the public to attention with it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's what we wanted to do. And by the way, I have a co-author. Her name is Stacey Colino. She's a longtime science journalist, so I want to give her credit as well. Yeah, so we feel this is an important topic and that it's something that people should be aware of and are becoming increasingly aware of, happily. And I'm happy to talk to your listeners about it.
Can we just go back to 1992 to give this a bit of context, when the first paper was published about plummeting worldwide sperm counts by somebody called Elizabeth Carlson? How do people notice something was going on?
That's a good question. So the senior author on this paper in 1992 was a physician named Neil Skekebeck, and he had noticed over the course of his practice treating reproductive problems in men that there were increasing problems and decreasing sperm counts. And he had the sense that this was an increase, but he wanted to look at the data. And so he had a junior scientist in his group take this on as the lead author, Elizabeth Carlson. And she addressed the question of how do sperm counts look worldwide and how have they changed over the prior 40 years? So that was the purpose. It came out of this sense from his practice, Skekebeck's practice, that things were getting worse. And much to his credit, you know, he sort of kicked off this field.
And you went into the work after that. You wrote a paper in 2017, which caused quite a storm, you know, addressing these plummeting figures head on. And just to tell our listeners, it was based on work with 42,935 men over 38 years. And you discovered that the total sperm count had fallen by more than 59%. You added the decline is steep, significant, and continuing with no signs of tapering off. What has happened?
In 2017, we found, controlling for everything we could, and that means controlling for how the sperm were counted, how old the men were, to the extent we could, we controlled for things like smoking and obesity, although it was very difficult in this huge study. And what we found was that the rate of decline was very similar to what Carlson and Skekebeck had published. I call this the 1% effect, because it affects so many, you know, we see it in so many outcomes. We see it in miscarriage. We see it in testosterone. We see it in testicular cancer going up. We see it, you know, so there's many, many things that are affected at about the same rate. So this 1% effect, which was reported by Skekebeck, was confirmed in our 2017 paper, okay? In 2022, two things were different. The first was that we had more of the world in our view. And that's because more of the world had published studies that we could use. And what we found with respect to this geographic question was that this was seen everywhere people looked. Significant declines now in 2022, which we had not seen in 2017, because we didn't have the data in 2017 to look at Africa and South America and to some extent Asia. So that update was broadening our finding. And perhaps more alarmingly, what we found was that if you look at the rate of decline all the way back to 1973, the rate of decline was a little over 1% per year. But if you looked after 2000, the rate of decline was 2.5% a year. Very much faster. And certainly there were fewer studies after 2000, so that's a little less stable. But it does suggest, first of all, that it's not getting better. I think we can safely say that. It hasn't slowed down. It's not getting better. And strong evidence that it is actually accelerating. The problem is accelerating. So it's not an old story.
So why has this happened? You know, your book talks about changes to our environment, chemicals. You know, has it something to do with the hyper-industrialized societies that we live in? Could you talk our listeners through, you know, what you think is causing this change from your research?
Sure. First of all, I want to say this is not merely evolution. It's too fast, right? It's, you know, 40 years, 50 years. This is not the rate at which evolution changes. So we put that aside. So then there's gene environment, right? So now we go over to environment. So environment, let me break that down into two categories. So we can talk about lifestyle, and we could talk about chemical insults or other physical insults from the environment. Okay, so obesity is a big one, and people who are obese have poorer fertility. There's lots and lots of data about that. Lower sperm count, longer time to pregnancy, and so on. Then there's diet, and the kind of diet you have matters a lot for your fertility and your ability to conceive, your sperm count, and so on. And that diet has changed. You know, for example, when we did a study of Western people using a Western diet versus a Mediterranean diet, we saw differences in sperm counts. So diet matters. I should perhaps have started with smoking, because smoking is a huge risk factor for poor fertility and poor sperm count and poor ovulatory function, whatever. At every reproductive endpoint is affected by smoking. So smoking rates changing could affect this. Alcohol matters, particularly binge drinking. Stress is actually really important. It's surprising sometimes to people that stress matters, but it really does matter for. And we showed that in a study in which we measured stress in men giving semen samples and showed that men who were stressed had lower sperm counts. So those are some of the major lifestyle factors that could be driving this. And I study those, and they're important. But what I want to bring to your listeners is another class of exposures, which maybe they're not so aware of. And those are the chemicals in our body that can affect our hormones. So our reproductive function, whether it's ovulation or sperm count, conception, so on and so forth, is dependent on kinds of hormones that everyone's familiar with: testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. These are what's called the steroid hormones, right? So if you're messing with those, you're messing with reproduction, okay? So what could do that? Well, it turns out that many of the lifestyle factors do that as well, but the chemicals that do that are chemicals that have been called endocrine disrupting chemicals, because they disrupt the endocrine system. And the chemical class that I particularly concentrated on was a class of chemicals that make plastic soft and flexible. You know, everyone has soft water bottles, right? Seen soft water bottles and tubing. And you can imagine in a hospital the amount of tubing that goes on there. In the milking a cow, you're going to do that through tubing. You know, processing spaghetti sauce, you're going to do that through tubing. Okay, our entire life is processed through soft plastic tubing. It's hard to find a place in your life where this doesn't happen. And what happens is that the phthalates, so that's a terrible word, but that's what they're called, a class of chemicals that are put into this plastic to make it soft. That's their function in the plastic, to make it soft. Okay. And they're not chemically bound to the plastic. So they hop out of the plastic into the milk or blood if it's in a hospital or whatever, And then it goes into our body. So there's so many outlets out there, so many ways for these things to come into our body.
And I know it seems very hard to judge how those have an impact, you know, on a person-to-person level as well. And, you know, endocrine system, we're talking hormones here. So obviously for men and women, they're going to have different impacts as well, of course.
That's true. But it's not that hard to say what they do to the body because you can study it. And that was studied first in rats and then in humans. And the most dramatic and the thing that I've studied most is what do these do when it's a pregnant woman who's getting exposed?
Mm.
Right? And that was shown first in the laboratory with pregnant rats, and then we looked in humans. And so what happened? Well, it turned out that when the mother was given in her diet some extra phthalates, similar to getting it through your food, you know, that's passed through the tubing and all that, but this is more direct. They just put it in her food, and then they saw what it did to her offspring. What they found was that these phthalates quite consistently and importantly changed the development of the male genitals. It sounds very dramatic, but actually it is pretty dramatic because what happens is that the genitals are developing in early pregnancy and they need testosterone. They need it at the right time. They need enough of it for the male genitals to differentiate from the female. Obviously, male and female genitals are different. They start out the same. They differentiate under the influence of testosterone. So testosterone is king here. It's really, really important. Okay. Now, if you're going to mess with that, you're going to mess with that process, right?
It's interesting you're talking about how that's been tested with, you know, pregnant females. And as somebody who's been pregnant myself, I remember my pregnancy being bombarded with how, you know, I shouldn't drink from plastic bottles. I shouldn't do things like this, which are directions often given to women, but very little is directed towards, you know, men, because obviously kind of the sperm comes from somewhere and a lot of reproductive problems are placed on women. But some of your work is interesting because it shows, you know, that a lot of the issue is to do with, issue is the right, probably the right word here, it's to do with what happens with men and the effects on testosterone. Why don't we hear about issues with male reproductive issues as much? Is it just sexism or is it something else?
First of all, I think there's the issue of shame that women have traditionally been held responsible for reproductive failure. That's been, you know, they keep the house and they keep the children and they should be responsible for making the children, pretty much. You know, the guy does his part, but she's got to make it all happen. And I think there is quite embarrassing to women, and women do naturally take responsibility for failure of reproduction. And men are actually quite ignorant. They're ignorant of their sperm count. They're ignorant of, you know, what their role is other than to just, when they're ready, shoot in the sperm, make it happen. That's how men see their role. They don't get tested. Women go to the OB/GYN every year, pretty much, you know, and get checked out and so on. Do men? No.
And that's obviously in the States. It's different, obviously, in the UK with the NHS and things are different here. But women do generally get tested over here much more than men do. But you also write about how fertility rates are dropping in younger women in some countries. Also, puberty is getting earlier with women. Can you tell us about that and what's going on there?
Yeah. So the fertility is a joint issue, right? So that's going to have male factor and female factor. What I refer to and what most people refer to when they say fertility is declining, they're talking about what's called the total fertility rate. And that's the number of children that a woman will have or a couple will have in their lifetime. And for things to remain stable, that has to be about a little over two. You know, one for each person and a little, yeah. So what's happened is that fertility rate since 1960, which is how long I've seen it tracked, has declined at, guess what? 1% a year. And actually, I should just add that right now, that critical number two, where you want for the society to replace itself, we're below two in many, many countries. And some countries, it's dramatically below two. Like in East Asia, like South Korea, it's 0.8. What that means is that the society is shrinking. the older people, you know, are living longer and they're going to die off, and there's not enough young people down there to support them. This is a worldwide challenge, if not catastrophe. As far as age of puberty, that's been much less studied, and we couldn't actually do a meta-analysis of age of puberty, I think, with any scope. But where it's been looked at, we see that it is changing, and particularly, and I'm not sure why this is, but the most dramatic finding has been in the U.S. in African-American young women getting breast development very, very young, like 7 years and 8 years. The rate of endometriosis is increasing, polycystic ovarian, PCOS, that's increasing. And, you know, we have to look at each one separately. But on the whole, it's not a healthy picture, and it's not getting better. That's the message, I think. Rather than going into the individual conditions right now, which we don't have time for, I would say that at around the rate of 1% per year, all of these, on average, endpoints are declining. And for those that have been looked at, these chemicals that affect hormones are influencing this decline. And the reason is that all of these things depend on these hormones. So if you have chemicals that are going to mess with these hormones, they're going to change these outcomes.
Obviously, this repeated motif, which is 1% decline, 1% decline, you know, 1%, 1 times 100 is 100, right? So we're looking at, are we looking at an end point? Well, are we looking at an end point, first of all, to ask the bleakest question?
Let me just point out that as rates of whatever decline, the question is, where does it end up? And I think you're asking, like, where's sperm count going? Is it? And many people ask, is it going to hit zero? The mean can't hit zero. And why is that? Because we're talking about a distribution, and the mean is the center of it. And so if the mean was zero, we'd have negative and positive sperm count. But you can't have negative sperm count, right? Just like you can't have negative body weight or negative height, you know. Yeah. So what you can do is you can get lower and lower and then gradually come closer and closer to zero, but you won't ever reach it. Nevertheless, what it means practically is making it harder and harder to conceive a pregnancy in the traditional way. So I think what the implications of this for us as a society is that we will have to turn more and more to other methods of conceiving a child.
One thing that's quite interesting about all this is that, you know, there are some people who might say, well, you know, these declines are fine. You know, we live in a world threatened by climate change. We need fewer people. How would you answer those people?
A couple of things I would say to them. First of all, if it's you or your child or your grandchild who's having trouble getting pregnant, you probably wouldn't say that. Secondly, I would say, I think it's a question of fundamental rights. Is it okay for the production of industrial chemicals to interfere with our right to have a child? And I believe that is a fundamental human right. Actually, also a right of non-human species, which are, by the way, also declining, Jude. This is not just a human story, although that's where I focused. So I would say that while I can appreciate the value of having fewer people on the planet and fewer demands on our resources and so on and so forth, absolutely, we can choose to do that as a society. I don't think it should happen as a result of industry pressure and the, you know, our demand for products in our home. This is not what should govern these big decisions. And let me just say finally that the impact of these chemicals and these disturbances, if you will, in fertility and reproductive function are not equal across the board. So people who are disadvantaged in various ways, having less money, having less time to educate themselves, living in places where they have better options in terms of food and products, it's not an equal opportunity risk, if you will. It's a risk that significantly and repeatedly see this impacts poor, disadvantaged communities. And so just from a human rights point of view, taking away the option to have a child from people, which is more likely if they're not getting the other support they need to live a healthy life.
So to finish, where are we now in 2024? Where are global fertility rates now? And where do we go from here? What can we do?
I think where we go, you're no longer in the EU, but the EU has done much better than many of us, including the US and probably Great Britain, in terms of putting in regulations that will make it less likely that we'll be subject to these chemicals. REACH was a very big step. Under REACH, manufacturers were supposed to test products before they distributed them in the market. That makes common sense. And that's what we do for drugs, medications. We test them before we put them in people, but we don't do that for the chemicals in our products. Mm. So that is a really, really big important step. And REACH is a step in that direction, although it's nothing works the way you hope it will 100%, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. In the US, you just put in a new chemical, see what happens. Well, what that means is that we, you and me, are the guinea pigs. So rather than testing it in a laboratory, we're being tested, right? We're testing out this product for the company. And if nobody gets sick, good. And if somebody gets sick, well, we'll use another chemical. That's the current practice. And if people object to that, they should let that be known. And they should think about ways to exert pressure on governments to bring in legislation that will not allow that.
Thank you so much for that conversation, Shanna. That was really interesting.
Thank you, Jude. And, I hope it does some good and people start paying attention. And anyone who wants to read more can read Countdown, where we talk about things that people can do to protect themselves.
Thanks so much, Shanna, for coming into the bunker today. And thank you all for listening. As you know, these important conversations cost money to make, so please consider supporting us for as little as £3 a month on the funding platform Patreon. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. Thanks so much and see you soon.
The Bunker was written and presented by Jude Rogers. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.